Hi, my name is Evan Mann, and I'm talking today, Thursday the 26th of February 2015, with Gordon Robson. We are meeting at the Curtin premises of the Canberra and District Historical Society as part of the Curtin Living Memories Project. Gordon is a long-term resident of Curtin, moving into the suburb with his wife Cynthia and their young family in February 1965. He was the first president of the Curtin Primary School PNC. Gordon was closely involved with the establishment of the Woden Valley Club here in Curtin back in the late 60s, and around the same time with the establishment of the North Woden Tennis Club. And it's about these things that I will be talking with Gordon today. So it's a pleasure, Gordon, to meet you here today. And while I say you've been a Curtin resident for over 50 years, in fact, you were born a long way from Canberra and also born into a large family.
Yes, this is... You think that I'd ever finish up in Canberra. I was born on Thursday Island in the Torres Strait a wonderful experience. Pre-war, I was born in 1933, and pre-war, Thursday Island was virtually an island paradise. I couldn't think of a better place to have been born and brought up. But unfortunately, even in an idyllic place like that, we were touched by the war, World War II, and in 1942, after the Japanese had bombed Horn Island, where the Americans had their planes, the authorities were frightened, of course, that they were going to start bombing Thursday Island then, because that's where the big guns were located. So everyone on the island was evacuated. We were given 24 hours to leave, and my mother at that time had seven children, including twins, 7 months old, and she left with two suitcases, as did everybody else. Is all I'd like to say is one can at least have some idea of how difficult my mother's life would have been, because we couldn't get to live in Brisbane even. You know, we came for Thursday Island, got off at Brisbane, and Mum's uncle, who was the postmaster, Gundabedi, eventually found a house for us in Laidley, and there we stayed for many years until my father was able to come down, and we eventually moved to Brisbane.
Okay, and school, you left school, got a job?
Yes, we with a big family like that, as is quite normal, I think, in those days. The first three boys, Roy, myself and Tom, we all had to start work at 14. Now, 14 was the legal age. You couldn't get a job until you were 14. And, in those days, of course, there were more jobs than people looking for them. So I got a job in a wholesale motor accessory firm at age 14, doing very menial tasks, and eventually, you know, graduated to more responsible positions there. And I was there with them for 9 years. And then at that time, circumstances changed. The firm wanted me to become a country traveller, newly married. I didn't want to be spending my time going out. And my father suggested I should join the public service, which I did. And without going into any detail, I passed all the exams, put into the Department of Taxation, a wonderful, wonderful department, straight off, and then eventually... through a series of circumstances and studies that I did at the University of Queensland, I eventually joined the audit office and was working up there, became eligible to become an audit inspector once you'd got certain qualifications. And as an audit inspector, I was stationed in, I went from Brisbane to Cooma. Cooma, of course, was a very active area then, you have the Snowy Mountain scheme, and they needed three inspectors there working full-time. And so I went down there, and my wife and I had 3 years there, you know, very active working. It was very busy. But the people of Cooma, a country town like that, just took us into their hearts. And we thoroughly enjoyed our 3 years there. Looking for a further advance in the public service, I applied for jobs in Canberra, got a position in the Public Service Board, which at that time was a rather, you know, one of the special departments, the Public Service Board. And so I came from Cooma to Canberra and worked in the Public Service Board. And I must just say one thing. When I first met my boss there, the first assistant commissioner, Ted Lightley, we were chatting away there, and Ted said, "Oh, Gordon," he said, "have you got accommodation?" And I said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Lightley." I said, "We've been allocated a house, you know, because it was on this, ACT housing list here." I said, he said, "Well, where are you?" And I said, "I've been allocated a house in Curtin." And Ted Lightley said, "Curtin," he said, "that's North Coomer again." He said, "You only get Pony Express twice a week." And because Ted at that time, I think, lived in Reed. So Curtin was really an extremity. You
on
know,
the edge, yes.
This was almost, I would say, a social experiment.
So tell us, how did you get a house in those days?
Well, as I said, because the three inspectors had to live in, we didn't have a choice, you know, we had to live there. And we were given a Snowy Mountains Authority house, and we lived in it. You know, we didn't pay rent or anything. That was just allocated
so
to
you're okay in Coomer. No,
yeah, we were put on the Housing Commission list, you know, to get a house in say, 3 years' time. And you wouldn't believe the coincidence. I was informed I was coming to Canberra on this promotion of the Public Service Board, and 3 days before I was due to arrive in Canberra, I got a letter from the ACT Housing List saying, "You are now available to have a house." What a wonderful... We came up, had a look at two other houses, but it was second-hand and used before. And I said, "Well, we have a new house in Curtin." So my wife and I came and had a look at it and said, "Love it."
Okay, so tell us what... This is February 65. So Curtin was about 6 months old at that stage.
Yes.
Tell us about Curtin, about what it looked like.
In those days, you had Adelaide Avenue. Yeah, there's still a main avenue there. And the first thing about Curtin is, as you come along Adelaide Avenue, the first ramp leaving the Adelaide Avenue was Curtin. And we did not at that time appreciate what we'd gained. This was, as far as anyone else concerned, this was the last place you could go to. But no, when we got here, I think the main thing physically you notice, there wasn't a tree. It had all been sheep farming. And honestly, I can't remember. There might have been half a dozen around the place. But, of course, very few houses had trees in them. Very few of the public areas had trees. So it was very bare as far as that goes. And the main thing I noticed about the thing, it was a very enthusiastic community. Everybody arrived and everyone was starting off, you know, on the same basis. New house, no lawns, no nothing like that. So for the first year, it was a frantic effort on everybody's part to try and get things into some sort of what we would regard as livable. Mm. And we all were out there digging out what, as several of us did, we didn't get machines in, you know, to dig up our front lawn, to plant things like that. We dug it up ourselves, you know, with a shovel and pick and everything like that. I managed to remove about 6 tons of rubble out of my front yard. And Graham Dreep across the road, all of us did the same. We had these huge heaps of rubble that eventually we had to get rid of. But that was the thing, I think, the enthusiasm of everyone wanting to get this into a recognisable suburban area.
We'll turn in a minute to social life in Curtin. Mm. But let's first go, which would have been, I think, something on your mind pretty early, because you've got four children, I'm sure. The oldest?
No. We had three at that
time. Three at that stage.
One
okay.
was born in Canberra later.
Okay.
Yep.
And the oldest would have been of school age, I expect, when you got here.
Yeah. The first one only, Gary, his birthday was in December, and he just turned 5. So we'd never had a child going to school before. You know, we knew very little about school life.
Yeah. Okay, and a school actually opens in Curtin in 1965.
Yep.
And your child goes to it, and obviously you have to get involved as well. But you got involved in a particularly strong way, didn't you?
Oh,
why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was terrible. I have to tell this story. Certainly new school, new child going to school. As a parent, I wanted to get involved. You know, I knew of PNCs. Parents of citizens, things like that. So we had to certainly go along and support our child by being on that. Anyway, the new principal, let's say brand new school, brand new principal. Bert York was the principal, and he had never even met his deputy principal before, Tom Morris. So you had this whole group of, shall I say, blank faces. You know, no one knew each other. So anyway, he called this PNC meeting, and there were about 130, 140 there, you know, very well attended. Everyone was the same as I, wanting to know what the school was going to do and concerned for our children. Anyway, so we arrived there, and just to go through it a bit more quickly, Bert York called for positions of president of the PNC, and of course there's no one. Everyone looked at each other like that, and there was no one. Was able to sort of get up and say, I'd nominate Gordon Robson or Evan Mann or anything like that. So eventually, at least someone had a bit of common sense. He said, look, Mr. York, may I suggest, you know, we don't know each other, and the best way to do that is with a social function. How about we hold a gathering in the beautiful big school hall? And that was taken up. They put up a little committee there. I didn't go on the committee, but I was down there because I live so close. And this function was set up as like a ball. There was dancing and things like that. Everybody bought food. Yeah, there was no catering or anything like that. It was so everyone was so enthusiastic at this, and it was a complete success. Yeah, I just mentioned one thing about that ball. They decided to have all things, sort of pieces of cloth, you know, coming out from a central area to make an arch over there to make it look spectacular. And the ceiling's about 80 foot high. Now, I am terrified of heights. And who did they pick to get up this 3-extension ladder with a drill to bore the hole to screw this ruddy big bolt to hold all this thing was me. I think I aged 10 years in putting that bolt on, and as far as I'm aware, Evan, it's still there. Anyway, but so that was my part in helping. But anyway, the function was a complete success. Yeah, we talked to each other. We found, you live in C Place here like that, and gradually, even before the evening was ended, there were a lot of faces you were familiar with. You immediately recognised where they were living. Anyway, so about a week after that, Bert York. I just forgot to admit, while we were at this gathering, Ron Merton, who was my backdoor neighbour and I'd already met, came across with another one of the fellows from C Place, and he said to me, he said, Gordon, look, he said, this is a new school, young people here. He said, we feel we need a young president of the PNC, you know. And I said, you're talking to the wrong man, Ron. I said, I've never had a child at school before. I wouldn't even know how a PNC operates. He said, no, he said, you'd get support. He's like, anyway, he said, look, would you let your name be put forward? And grudgingly he said yes. He said, by the way, he said, look, see that grey-haired fellow over there, tall fellow in a distinguished suit? I understand he's going to accept nomination. Someone else over here, equally distinguished. So I said, fine, yeah. Who's going to pick me?
Had you been in a leadership position in a community organisation before?
Never. I had never been in any sort of organisation like that whatsoever. Anyway, so when the meeting came, Bert York called for nominations, and immediately Ron Merton jumped up and said, I nominate Mr. Gordon Robson. And I can't think of his name now. But anyway, he immediately said, I second the nomination. And Bert York said, but Mr. Robson liked to stand up. So I said, do you accept the nomination? I said, yes, Mr. York. Yeah, clapped. Yeah. Anyway, you imagine what happened then. They called for more nominations. Someone immediately got up and nominated whatever his name was, this tall gentleman. He immediately stood up and said, sorry, Mr. York, I decline. Second fella got up. Sorry, Mr. York, I decline. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I realised I had been conned. So everyone clapped. He said, there being no further nominations, I declare Gordon Robson president of the PNC. Mr. Robson, would you like to come up now and carry on the rest of the
meeting? Yeah, chair the meeting. Yeah.
Well, I had to get all the other office bearers in. Vice presidents, two, treasury, secretary. Yeah. So I had to go through that. They had the list there, yeah. And believe you me, it was learn on the job.
Yeah. This was just the beginning of it, wasn't it? This was quite a momentous year for the school.
Oh,
the PNC president was in the middle of it. Just tell us about some of the things that are happening in the school.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, once the committee had been gathered together, we immediately agreed on monthly PNC meetings and things like that. And, of course, the normal type of things associated with a new school. And, you know, the one, the most important and gave us more trouble than anything else, uniforms. No trouble with the young boys there, you know. Shirt, I think it was grey with darker grey shorts and things like that. But trying to get the women, some wanted frocks, some wanted skirts and blouses, some wanted something else like that. And we had to set up a subcommittee, of which luckily I got my vice president to chair, to decide on uniforms. But, yeah, there were things like that, you know, that contributed to the workings of the PNC. And as we started to get more, because it was a very young community, as we got more students coming into the school, it didn't take long for Bert York and Tom Morris to realise that they were getting a problem student-wise. The school, if I remember correctly, had been set up for about 370. That's a figure that springs to mind, about 370. And that they provided everything for that. Within, before June, if I remember, it was over 500. And Bert York and them were really being put to the test. They had sufficient teachers, if I think, but of course the facilities. And it got worse after that, you know. Before we finished, the end of the year, I think we had roughly 700. Yeah, anyway, and you can imagine the pressure that applied. Mm. So, very active, you know, with Bert York. We went and saw the education authorities and pointed this was coming out and pointed out that at that time they were holding classes in corridors, you know, and very much problems with all the other associated facilities, toilets, sporting, everything to get the kids outside. So, anyway, and we weren't getting anywhere. So by August, Bert York contacted one of the local television stations, I think it was at that time Channel 7, and invited him to come to the school. And they did. They came round. He invited me to come down with him as a president of the PNC, you know, and I spoke to them about it and showed all the problems, and Bert York did. And they said, right. And they ran it that night on the local. And it was quite something, you know. The very next day, Bert York got a call from the education department saying, look, the minister is very concerned, you know. If only you shouldn't have approached the thing. If you'd have come to us, we'd have been able, well, Bert York immediately was able to produce all the paperwork, everything, communications, phones, things like that. Cut a long story short, very embarrassing. They immediately obtained five, and as far as I'm aware, ours was the first school in Canberra to get portable schools. They had to come from Adelaide. They had them there.
And you got them in 5 days?
No. Within 5 days, they said they were going to get them. It took another 4 weeks, September, October. But at least we had five portable classrooms there, you know, and they were trying. And, of course, the associated thing was it accelerated the completion of North Curtin. Mm. You know, North Curtin was going to be segregated by roads. If you lived on that side of the road, you went to north, this side, south. And it wasn't going to be finished till about June. They got it ready for students to attend at North Curtin, ready for February the next year. It was a real job. But we got you know, we got the results we wanted, and you had to do that by being proactive.
How did you enjoy being in the public limelight?
Good. Look, it's surprising. I've never done anything like that before. Now, what I did find is I was surprised at how quickly I became competent in the job, you know. I'd never heard of someone saying, what's the query? Challenge your decision, Mr. President, you know, a challenge from the floor, you know. And a couple of times I had to leave the chair, the vice president went in, and I had to come down there and defend my position, what I'd made a decision from the floor. And I had two or three of those, and if I may say so, I won them all. So I was starting to feel, you know, confidence came with that. And that, if I may say so, helped me the rest of my life. You know, the fact I had this responsibility sudden thrown on me, and it really helped me develop.
Okay. being part of a school, I'm sure, was, as well as having the, those obvious personal advantages of development and so on, I imagine it was a wonderful social experience too. Let's talk a little bit about how you coming, you and your wife and family coming into a new community, how you made it socially. I think we have a bit of an idea with the school, but go on and elaborate on that.
School, of course, they had the normal functions, you know, and just one thing in social, they decided to have a, fundraising, you know, at the school. And there again, would you believe it, they'd arranged for the head of the Legislative Association there, or Legislative Assembly at the time, to come and open the FATE. And, of course, they rang up about half an hour before and said they couldn't. So they rang someone else and he couldn't come over. So Bert York said, Gordon, you're going to have to open the FATE. So that was another little thing. But, socially, the school was great. You know, we all had that. But if I could just relate to one other thing that showed you how community-minded, and I think my little story here was probably duplicated a lot around the suburb. We just moved in only in about 3 weeks, and there was a knock on our door on a Saturday morning, and I went there, and there was this lady there. So I looked at her, and she said, look, my name's Loris Carey. You don't know me, and I don't know you. She said, and we're not going to get to know each other if we don't get together. She said, Keith and I, my husband, would like to invite you around to our house for drinks and things like that. And, next Saturday or something like that close. He said, would you like to come? And, of course, we said, we'd be delighted. And people will recognise it here and made us laugh. And she said to my wife, she said, and bring a plate. Well, in Queensland, we had no connection with that. And then she looked at Cynthia and she suddenly said to her, and put something on. So Cynthia realised, you know. But this is a little microcosm, you know, of what was, I think, you know, going right throughout the suburbs, because it was at the higher level or larger levels and lower levels like this. But that little group, there were six couples, we started off, and you know how people can just hit it off. We thoroughly enjoyed that first gathering. We all agreed to gather again, and we went around to each other's houses for almost 7 years afterwards, you know, before the first couple started to move and things like that. But that was just wonderful. It was the making of us again. Mm. You know, Cynthia was there, had an immediate group of friends. The ladies used to visit, you know, for morning teas and stuff like that. And every one of them, you know, was just bumped. So we had them at a succession of dinners, and it's just such a wonderful feeling. And you imagine how much we gained out of that.
Mm. On the subject of social networks in the suburb, this takes us on to the Woden Valley Club, of course.
Mm.
For those of listeners who don't know about the club, it used to be located on the site currently occupied by the Green Rose Park Apartments.
That's right, next to the service station.
That's right, right in the middle of Curtin. Now, we're talking here about the late 60s, aren't we?
Yes.
And you had some involvement in the establishment of the club.
Oh, yes, as at least as president of the PNC. And people knew me. That's one thing about it. I was recognised. So don't forget, we didn't have the Curtin shops then. Yeah, there's nothing located like that. We had the one corner shop on Theodore Street. Yeah. Other than that, you shopped at Marnica or Kingsford. Marnica was ours, but... yes, and so there was a feeling, again, you know, at the higher level, we had the school PNC, but that was limited, you know, restricted in its own area. And there were probably other groups, whatever they might be gathered
groups.
Together. Yeah, church groups and that. Cynthia joined the church as soon as we got here. And again, see, Ron Merton was really a very active man. Yeah, he'd been manager of the milk factory here in Canberra or something like that anyway. And so he was quite well known commercially too. And he and two or three other businessmen said, look, we need a social club. And they approached the government and said, they were allocated this quite a large block at the time. And so, they formed a board of directors. Thank goodness. I said, no, I've got enough on my plate. But Ron was on that. I don't know who the chairman was, but a very competent group. And so this developed fairly quickly, you know, with government assistance. So they got money in that. And the club was built in a reasonable amount of time. It got a liquor licence from the government, and it became really a social hub. We had I just forget how many, but hundreds of members at that time, paid their fees to join, things like that. And various functions were organised there. You could hire the club as well and things like that. And so it became... what aided that was, of course, once we knew that this was going ahead, they said, look, now we're going to have to send pamphlets out or get pamphlets out to all the suburbs, you see. And so, of course, I was one, and I think we had about 50 people taking pamphlets around the place and all the letterboxes, you know, and the response was overwhelming that gave the board, you know, feelings that the club could develop and would have a good membership.
So if I went there over a weeknight, what would I have found?
Oh, well, the bar was always open. You know, a lot of people used to come in there because they didn't want to go to pubs. There was no station, no hotel here, mainly in Civic and that. And so the bar was a central meeting point. I remember they had, a billiard table and stuff like that. And also they'd have gatherings, you know, like they have people slide nights for various groups like that and other organisations. Maybe like the quilt group might have met there and things like that. But they had the facilities for other groups. So there always seems to be something going on. And something, if I remember rightly, was always arranged for the weekend. Okay. Saturday nights, you know, we had some funny functions there. You know, I remember one of them decided to have a ballet group, you know, perform at one of these functions there. And of course, they're all men, you know. We had to dress up in these little poofoos, you know, the little things like that, bare chested and slippers and that all right. like that. And thankfully, I hope all the photographs have been destroyed by this time, but I was one of them. But, of course, the popular ones were the men with big, hairy chests dancing around like these fairies. But a very, very, you know, very good centre for social occasions for anyone.
This was pre-pokey days, of course, wasn't
it? Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, no pokies were even considered
and
at that
also
time.
Prior to the Southern Cross Club. And
yes, yes. Now, this is where the dichotomy came. If we'd have kept going, you know, and really applied ourselves, but at the same time, the Catholic Association decided that this was a new area, because don't forget, it was going to be Woden, a huge area, district, not just Curtin. Hughes was there and Lyons was being built, things like that. And they had the foresight to see what was coming up. So they then got permission and started building the Southern Cross Club. Now, immediately that started, there were a number of Catholics, you know, associated with ours, who drew all their activities, gave all their attention then and enthusiasm for the building of that. And so we just missed out, because shortly after that started, the Hellini Club started. So you have two very large clubs in Curtin. Curtin has been well suited by its two big clubs here. You know, we just missed out, and eventually it just died.
Okay. When I rang you a month or two ago to ask about the possibility of this this conversation, your wife told me you're actually out of the tennis club.
Yes.
And I gather the tennis club was actually the North Woden Tennis Club in Hughes, just on the other side of Yarra Glen from Curtin. And I understand that you have been involved with that club for a long time as well.
See, once again, as I said, some people have greatness thrust upon them. I was conned so many times in my lifetime. Yes, I'd been playing tennis all my life, and I played in Coomer. And when we came up here, I was told to join one of the tennis clubs here because there was nothing in Woden at that time. And again, you know, I went on to the ACT LTA, at that time the Lawn Tennis Association, onto their committee here. I got to know the president, Ken Willis, and he said, come on to the committee with us. And 1967, it only was 2 years later, they realised, of course, you know, that the young people here, all certainly sport-minded, you know, other codes were catered for, but there was nothing in North Curtin. In Woden, call it Woden at that time. So they called a meeting at one of the halls in Hughes. And again, you know, 130, 140 people very interested in this. And it soon became evident that it was a good proposition, you know, to build these courts here. And so once again, they showed the evidence to the government. They gave them the funds. And the four first courts were built at North Woden there. And they were just four courts, dirt courts, no clubhouse, no nothing. We used to have to put tarpaulins up for the kids. But anyway, so they called this meeting there. And again, Ken immediately said, well, look, we need to get a committee going straight away to run the club. Now, I'd like to call for the position of president. Nope. No one. No one at all said, please, you know, you can't get it going without a president. Now, lots of people keen to play, but no one wanted. So Ken turned to me and said, Gordon, look, he said, would you be president for the first year? And I thought, oh, no. Wait till Cynthia hears about this. I said, all right. So I immediately started president, you know, but the committee was organised like that. They were very keen to get going. And so we started off there like that. The biggest thing about that club was the naming of it. Yeah, you wouldn't idea the names that were put forward, you know, Curtin Tennis Club, Yarra Glen, because of the road and all these sort of things. Yeah. And I'll never forget, I just can't think of his name now. I remember he was a senior public service there. And he said, look, this is the first club in Woden. He said, now, Woden's going to be a big district, folks. He said, there will be clubs here and clubs down there. He said, now, we're at the northern end of Woden. He said, why don't you call it North Woden? Dead silence, and everyone said, what a great idea.
Logical idea, yes.
Now, common sense won out, yeah. So it was called the North Woden Tennis Club, and within a period of time, we had lots. We knew we were going to need more courts later on.
You had lots of young people playing, I guess.
Yeah, there wasn't at the time. No, we didn't. And we realised any tennis club, as it has in the past, is going to be its youth. So we wanted to get the junior tennis going quickly. And three of us said, look, the only way we're going to do that, we've got to try and attract young people there. So we put up a screen there saying, look, we were going to start running classes of a Saturday morning. You know, we weren't coaches, but we were enthusiastic and we'd played all our lives, so we knew a bit about the game. So so we put this up, and the first, I remember, Mick Hogg and I can't think of his other name, Bill. Anyway, we arrived there on a Saturday morning and we had about 19. Yeah, which is great, you know. And everyone had to bring their rackets. That's the one thing we said we were not going to, we didn't have the facilities for that. So everyone had to arrive with a racket. And we'd gone to, of course, through the ACTLDA, they gave us a couple of hundred old balls, you know, that had been around. So we had plenty of balls to hit around. So 19 the first week. I think we doubled by the second week. 38. By the end of the fourth week, we had nearly 90. Now, four courts with 90 kids trying to org their, from the good players to the very young ones. And what we soon realised was people came along and said, what a great opportunity. We'll drop our kids off here. They can run around learning tennis while we go out to Saturday morning shopping.
Of course, yes.
They disappeared. They did whatever they like, and we realised again we were being conned.
How did you cope with 90 kids?
We did the best we could. Well, by that time, of course, we had at least another four or five people agreed that they'd come down, and we tried to, very hard with only four courts, you got 20 on each, but we did the best. Anyway, very soon afterwards, one of the good coaches came up and said, look, I'd like to establish a school here, and we were glad to hand it over to him. But I will say this. In about 3 years from when that first days we got the thing, North Woden won, I think, six out of the seven junior tournaments. Mm. The junior tournaments that were being run around there, we had the best teams, and everyone pennant. We had our clubhouse loaded with pennants. Mm. The best use of time and effort that I've ever been associated with.
You said when we're walking in, you had a bit of a bodgy knee. You're still playing tennis?
Oh, yes. I'm still playing tennis. 62 years. Love it. I couldn't give it up. And I'm waiting, Evan, at the moment on a knee replacement. But being on the public system, not having private, I've been waiting now 12 months and it's killing me, the pain. I still try and play tennis. I run around. I'm very good at making up numbers. Like instead of, I play at Reed, a good club, and instead of having seven on the court, which is a deadly name because three don't play, they won't play cutthroat, I come along and make it eight, and although I can't run very much, I can hit enough balls to make it. Couldn't give it up, and I'm just waiting for this to allow me to continue playing. Yep.
But let's just talk about your career. I know you finished your public service career back in the 80s.
Yeah, 89.
89?
Yeah.
And then you found a new career, which I was fascinated to hear about. Tell us about
just barely. One thing I liked about my public service career, some people start in a department and will stay there 40 years. 40 years, they'll be there in the one department. Whatever they do, I don't know. But I was very lucky. I kept shifting, you know, from the Public Service Board to War Service Homes to this department, Interior, and I kept going. And I was never more than 3 or 4 years in any department, and that was a blessing for me. You know, you were fresh every time instead of sitting there. And but I finished up back in the National Audit Office. I went up as Queensland for 3 years as the Chief Auditor, which was a very wonderful time in my life, you know. Big fish, little pool up there, you know, one of the branch heads in Queensland. It gave me a very active public service life. But when I retired, and I was, you know, no problem in retiring, I had to because of health reasons at that time. I didn't know about them until I retired. And so we had a big tour overseas, Cynthia and I, in 90. And then I was looking for a job. And, of course, I've been offered any number of jobs, accounting, auditing, Gordon, any days, you know, you pick your own. And you, once you've been in that area all your life, you don't have anything to do with it. It was just coincidentally, my next-door neighbour was speaking to me, Bill Creswell, and he said, Gordon, he said, would you like to work at the High Court of Australia? And I said, what do they do at the High Court? He said, they have the case there. He said, but, you know, there are people there. I'm one, he said, an attendant, and we show people through the court. He said, it's a wonderful job, 9:30 in the morning start, 4 o'clock finish, you know, and they have two types, permanents and casuals. He said, I'm a permanent, he said, but they do need more casuals. And I said, no, that sounded good. Yeah, it sounded attractive to me. It's totally different what I was doing. Cut a long story short, I put my application in. A couple of weeks later, I got an interview there, and I was lucky, you know, because of my at least senior career. I was a director in the audit office when I left. They were quite impressed with me, and I started within about a week and loved it. Honestly, you couldn't believe it. That was my, why I ever became an accountant, Evan, I don't know. That was my forte, you know. Public relations, I loved it. In fact, I got on so well with people there because Cynthia and I had the fortunate thing of having travelled several times overseas. You know, we'd visited every country in Europe and stuff. And it was amazing. You talk to people and I say, where are you from? They say, oh, we're from Sweden. I say, we've been to Sweden. You've been to Sweden, you know, and you talk like this. And all the other fellows are saying, for God's sake, God, let them go, you know. And I'm saying, but they're quite happy for me to talk to them, you know, like that. So eventually I got called Motor Mouth, which I took as a name of honour, don't worry, like that. But it was wonderful, you know. And as I said, I really got enthusiastic, and I did have some ability I soon picked up. And I had two very wonderful things happen to me there. One of the big colleges from Sydney came up. They used to bring students up there like that. And, we'd give them talks, you know. They'd booked and this is in court number one, you know, the big one where the seven judges, the High Court, sit. And so I was just happened to be on duty that day. You know, one day you're on court one, two, three. Yeah, you're very. This day was coincidences again. I was on court one. So they came in. There were about 150 of them. Yeah, there were two groups. One had gone to one of the other places and some had come to the High Court. So I started off and, I'd worked out a pretty good spiel to thing like that, and I love the court, you know. I love what it did. And so I was able to not only just tell them about that, but embellish, you know, little things like that, little things that happened here. Yes. I did, and I was good at it. I'm not patting myself on the back. And anyway, when I finished, it went for about 40 minutes, you know, a half an hour you allow. Anyway, and the one of the teachers came up, he said, Mr. Robson, he said, I've been bringing students here, he said, for many years, he said, that is the best talk that I have ever heard. He said, we're bringing the other students here. He said, I want you to give the same talk tomorrow, which means I had to change courts. But anyway, they went and he went and evidently approached the person in charge, Mr. Pelly, Joe Pelly, and said, could Mr. Robson do it again tomorrow? He said, yes, all right, we'll switch courts. And I did. I thought that was one of the the finest things that ever happened to me, you know. And so, but that was, again, my association with this wonderful building, with all the history with it and things like that. Yeah, and there were a couple of other things like that came up.
That's great. You're still working, you tell me.
No. Oh, yeah, sorry, I am, yeah, sorry, yeah. When you say working, I mean to think full-time.
No.
My son has a business which is, he developed himself, you know, started in a garage, but no little things like that, a business involving spray tanning, you know, of ladies and things like that. And from the garage, he has now a large warehouse at Queanbeyan. He also has a very good agent in Ireland that sells a lot of his products. They developed everything themselves, the spray, the equipment. They won a design award for this new gun they designed from the design people in Sydney. They went down for some award thing anyway. And also it got so big in America, my number three son, who was then general manager with the firm here in Canberra, he asked Brett would he go over because they could see how big it was going to be. And, if we were going to do it properly, they needed a CEO over there. And Brett said, yes. So he's been over there over 4 years now as a CEO.
And what do you do in the business?
I'm the what they call the restocking. Yeah, see, everything that goes out, one of the things Mark insists on, must be in plastic. Yeah, it's everything, every little part. There are things that they call sticky feet. You know, like you don't get up there and have the stuff walking on. So they have these little sticky feet that they sell, and I put them into packets,
okay.
See? Everything like that. Okay. So, and there are so many other associated products like that, hair nets, everything. I put into plastic, and it's a great job.
Well, it's great to be so active.
Yeah. It is.
I think we'll call it quits there, Gordon.
Yep.
Look, it's been a pleasure talking with you and hearing about such a great period of life in Curtin.
Yeah, well, look, as I said, we have been very fortunate just winding up. We arrived in Curtin in 65 and we had a problem there, you know, where we had to move out of our house for reasons. And we didn't, you know, we looked at houses further down the valley and stuff like that and we said, oh, no. And weren't we lucky in Dawson Street, and the fellow next door was a friend of mine who worked with me, and he said, Gordon, there's a house next door. Anyway, cut a long story short, we bought this house in Curtin so we didn't have to leave. And my wife and, as I said, you know, we've now got seven grandchildren as well. We can't speak enough about the wonderful life that we have enjoyed in this wonderful suburb.
What a great note to finish on. Thank you, sir.
A pleasure. How did it go?
Lovely. It's great.
What was that, 40 minutes?
Yeah, a little bit over. Mm-hmm. Maybe a minute or two over.
That's what we're aiming for. That was great.
Well, you've got me relaxed. You gave me out all the right feels and things like that. And as you can see, I talk.
You do talk. I don't have to do much there at all.
I can talk about anything.
Well, especially those things. That was terrific.
Can I tell you something that I've told very few people? You've got 5 minutes to
speak. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
It must have been 66 because I was working at the Public Service Board at the time.
Yep.
And, of course, as you know, Lyndon Johnson was made president.
Yeah,
right,
yeah.
And remember, he came out here to Australia
visiting.
You see. I was at the Public Service Board, you know, along King's Avenue there. And everyone was given time off, you know, to go and see him, wave him as he passed, you see. And would you believe it again, just as we were ready to leave, everyone was given, you know, to give the time to get down there, I had a phone call from one of the departments. So I was about 15 minutes late, walked down to the thing and it was packed, you know, 10 deep. And I thought, oh, I'm not going to see anything here. So I walked up I said, I'm going to get up closer to the Parliament House. And it was just worse up there, of course, you see. Anyway, I get to the end of the street, you know, the little street there where it stops and there's Parliament House there and they got the road up the side. This is the old Parliament House, of course. And I struck Jimmy Jorgensen there. Jimmy and I were a good player. He was a player at a tennis player.
Yeah,
Jim. So I said to Jim, I said, look, I'm going to try and get up closer, you know, to see him. I said, we're not going to see anything here. He said, all right. So we started to walk. We started to walk down towards the thing. And as soon as we broke away from here, I saw this policeman come. Now, and as he got closer, he was a sergeant, you see. And he stopped us there. And he said to me, I'm sorry, gentlemen, you're not allowed here.
Mm.
He said, you'll have to go back. Now, what sort of brain thing I had. I don't know. I looked him in the Sergeant and I said, it's all right, Sergeant. I said, I'm parliamentary staff. And Jim walked off and the Sergeant did nothing. He just turned around, walked out, and I followed him down. So got to the steps of the Parliament House, got up there, and then I saw that. And look, I will tell you this. I'm dressed in a lovely dark brown suit with huge black sunglasses. Most important, huge black sunglasses. Got to the top. Anyway, started talking to a few of the people. Most of them are photographers and journalists up there, you see. Anyway, we chatted away for a while. Next minute, in come the cavalcade. Out of the big van, you know, the Secret Service people, and out come Johnson with Harold Holt at the time, you know. Up they went up the stairs like that, and I thought, gosh, look at that, you know, it's wonderful. And Lady Bird is with him. So anyway, then one of the fellows, the journalist, said, he said, I'm going to go down and have a look at the car. And so three or four of us were down. I just joined them. I walked down with them like this to see them. We stand there looking at the car, and they said, no, keep away, you know. And just at that moment, one of the journalist people for the Parliament or something came down and said, gentlemen, I've got the President's speech here. He said, you know, he's making it at the moment. He said, here are your copies. So I put my hand up, bang, I have a look like this. Anyway, we're just standing there looking at it, and the one fellow said, look, we better go inside, you know, to get our stories ready. You see, we've got the speech now that he's going to make in there. So they started heading off round to the Senate side. Oh, I walk with them. Straight in the middle, and I'm talking away like this, you see. They've all got their now. They all had their big accreditation passes on their thing. I got nothing except my big black sunglasses and this white paper in my hand. Get to there, and there's dozens of people. There was Secret Service, obviously. There were police there. There were attendants. Yeah. And things like that. I walked straight through. Walked through. Went up there with all the journalistics. I'm up in the back room. I didn't know where the hell I was. They all went to their rooms, you know, to start typing. So I'm looking down, I thought, I'll go down this corridor. So I went down to this corridor, and there's a door at the end, you know. So I opened the door. So where am I? Right in the main hall, you know.
King's Hall.
Yeah, King's Hall. So I'm standing there like this, and I thought, oh, look at all these people here like that. And here again, you talk about coincidence after coincidence. Just as I stood out there like that, someone's saying to me, hey, Gordon, what are you doing here? And the attendant outside the Senate Chambers thing there was a tennis player. Of course he knew me. I went down with shake. I didn't realise how important this was. I just shook him by the hand and said, we're talking tennis, and the bell's rang. He said, oh, Gordon, I've got to go. He said, you know, we're getting closing up, something like that. So I thought this was jolly fine. So I just walked out and stood inside the hall against one of the pillars. And I'm standing there like this, and I look around, and in front of the King George statue at the time was obviously a Secret Service agent from America, because young. Yeah, he didn't have sunglasses on. He had a thing in his ear. And crew cut and everything like that, you know. And I just sort of went like that and looked at him. And as I looked at him, he went, and I went, I couldn't believe it. You know, he just went like that. Anyway, cut a long story short, I wasn't walking. I was nowhere near the floor at that time. So everyone started to mill around there like that. And I noticed he left his place. So he went that side. And I'm milling around. All these people here never took my sunglasses off. Anyway, one of the fellows came along then again, and he's handing out the list of people going into the luncheon, you know, and the thing. He knew me from tennis. And he said, what are you doing here, Gordon? And I said, I'm on special duty for the Prime Minister's Department. Oh, right. I said, can I have one of those? Yes, I got one of those. Then I noticed that there was activity taken down where the people came out at the bottom of the hall, you see, like that. And I noticed the Secret Service man had come to the middle. Yeah. So I went and sat in the middle. He's there and I'm here on this side. See? And so he went down to the bottom. And then as the President the Prime Minister and his wife, Nalika, came up between there. He's out there like this, you know, going back, 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 and walking up with him, you see. And here I am, back, back, you dog, you know, keep back there. I walk right up the top like that, and, you know, they went into the library then for the luncheon. So I'm standing there like this. The other fellow disappeared wherever he went. And here's the fellows, you know, they're checking everybody's thing, you know, as they come into the luncheon. In a thing, I just walked around behind him and went straight in there, and I'm having a look around, making sure he was all right.
So you're obviously a spook.
Oh, look, I don't think my head belonged to my shoulders. I've only told this to about, I told my dad, of course, he couldn't believe it. So anyway, by that time, there was nothing more I feel I could do. So I just walked out the front, went back to the public service board, and they said, "What the hell are you being?" He said, we're waiting for you to play bridge, you know. And I told them, you know, very briefly what I'd done. And one of the fellows straight away said, "You go down to the Daily Telegraph," he said, "they'll give you $10,000 for that story." And I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, I never thought of money or anything. And I said, "No, hold on, no, I've probably broken a few laws."
You're a public servant, that's right, you've been struck.
And I said, "Oh, God, you imagine if I'm thrown into jail, yeah, what'll happen?" So I just did nothing about it. And I still got the speech and the book with the things.
And the story is now recorded for posterity.
Yeah, yeah, thank you very much indeed. I'm glad that that's turned off. But I just had to tell somebody. It seemed to be a part of me, you know. Yeah, I just couldn't help myself. What made me ever say, "I'm parliamentary"? Now, look, it's all the sergeant had to say was, "Could I see your pass,
yeah,
sir?" Yeah. Stop me in my tracks, not have gone back. Mm. And everything flowed out from there. And, of course, I suppose if I had have told the story, you know, he might have got a little bit of a knuckle wrapping and things like that. But, oh, gosh, I tell you, the greatest event happening. Mind you, of course, I was picked for the coronation. I went to London and marched in the Queen's coronation there in 1953. And also, I was specially picked to stand guard. I stood guard in Buckingham Palace.
Well, you were in the CMF or something?
Yeah. In the CMF. I'd been National Service in 51.
Yeah.
And they wanted one ex-National Service trainee who stayed on anyway. They picked me, you know. 97 nominations from Queensland, and I got it.
Okay, well, it's been great to hear this story. Well, story, should I say. I think we'll call it quits there, right?
Yeah, thanks very much. Okay. But that was something I've had to blab out. It's unique.